combined, radical change, right? And when there is a, so I have a whole chapter looking at each of the nine cases and trying to figure out behind the scenes, where did this come from? Because when you see something that turns on a dime like that, a sea change, you really want it to be, to make sense. You want someone to have at least decided to do that.
We have 20 seconds.
Okay. And part of what I came up with was this just happened because technology, this goes back to Snowden, because of technology, it's impossible to hide who's in contact with whom anymore. And cases are viable to investigate now that weren't before. That's not something Obama did or Bush did. It's just the way it is in the 21st century. And investigative journalism is still grappling with the implications of that.
But did you expect Obama to do better, since he had attacked Bush so much on these issues?
Well, I don't want to say better or worse. That's not my role. I'm just trying to explain why did this happen, this amazingly surprising turn of events.
Part two at democracynow.org. Charlie Savage, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist at The New York Times. His new book, Power Wars, Inside Obama's Post-9/11 Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The time is 8 a.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned. Paul Roland is coming up with Wednesday Talk Radio. His guest is social justice activist and writer Harsha Walia.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first CMJ College Day on Tour, Saturday, November 7th at Holocene in Portland. College Day aims to fill a day with great programming and speakers from and related to college and non-commercial radio, allowing both new and experienced voices from the radio world to talk about the issues that matter most to them. At this all-ages event, there will be live music, innovative workshops, presentations, and interviews with key members of the music and radio world from the Pacific Northwest and beyond. Again, that's College Day on Tour, Saturday, November 7th at Holocene, 1001 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Victory is mine, yes. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media Convergence, a regional gathering of community-based media makers sharing space and skills to build solidarity on November 14th and 15th on the Portland State University campus. There will be skill shares, issue-based strategy sessions, regional breakouts and workshops, as well as movie screenings and a keynote presentation, editors of Octavia's Brood, science fiction stories from social justice movements. Again, that's the Cascade Media Convergence, November 14th and 15th, on the Portland State University campus in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Milagro Theater, presenting La Muerta Baila, Milagro's 20th annual Day of the Dead production, playing now through November 8th. Tickets at milagro.org.
And good morning. I don't know about you, but I've been bored with the USA for a long time, and I have to live here like the rest of us. Anyway, my name is Paul Roland. This is KBOO Community Radio. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and we are going to talk about imperialism, climate crisis, and struggle with our guest, Harsha Walia, from the unceded Coast Salish territories, otherwise known as Vancouver, BC. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. So you're going to be in town on Sunday. That's going to be from 5 to 7, just to get that out for anybody who has to leave before you have to go, at the First Unitarian Church up at on Southwest 12th Street in downtown Portland. And that's going to be the subject of your talk. So maybe just to give people a little bit of a feel for what you've been doing, your organizing. I know you helped start the group and been organizing with the group No One Is Illegal. Just tell us a few things about the kind of work and organizing that you've been doing before we get into the subject of your talk here in Portland.
Yeah, No One Is Illegal is a migrant justice group, and we started shortly after 9/11 with the increase in attacks on migrant and refugee communities, very similar to what was happening in the U.S., was, of course, happening all around the world, including in Canada, with, extensive racial profiling and increase in detentions and deportations and raids on migrant communities. So the work of No One Is Legal is primarily to organize within immigrant and refugee communities against racial profiling, against deportations, against detention. And for us, the key kind of frameworks that we organize within is that we are a justice-based group. So for us, it's not a matter of charity or kind of this kind of multicultural benevolence that a lot of discussions around immigration are focused around. So, a lot of immigrant rights groups or kind of liberal immigration organizations really focus on the idea of immigrants being good for the economy and, kind of being model minorities. And for us, we believe, again, that, no one is illegal, which means that every migrant has a right to dignity, including those who are deemed undesirable. So people who have been incarcerated, for example, or, people with disabilities, because we see that, again, this is a struggle for justice and not one for, respectability. So our framework is one that is anti-colonial, anti-racist, and, broadly anti-oppressive in all forms.
And you yourself, I understand, are from an immigrant family yourself. Has that informed your work?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I'm a first, I forget how the generations work, but my family is from India, and I migrated myself about 10 years ago. Here to Canada. So my experience as an immigrant, as someone who faced a removal order, someone who was in detention for a brief period of time, all of that's influenced my work in this context, for sure.
Oh, I'm sorry, I actually didn't realize you yourself came. I guess I hadn't read enough about you. I have a little bit of experience with that. My father himself was an immigrant from Italy, but it's very different to experience it directly yourself, I imagine. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So you're going to be here talking about some pretty intense things. The word imperialism. I played that song by The Clash, obviously advisedly. They being one of the one of the few rock bands, punk bands that made got out into the public airwaves more than others that, talked openly about such things, talked about Yankee soldiers. The talking about imperialism was subject that in the movement, if there is such a thing, was a lot more prevalent, back in the 60s and 70s. It seems like, at least, in the general circles, activist circles, it's not really talked about them, which was kind of strange if you look at the way the world is going with just the incredible increasing use of destabilizing military interventions around the world by the United States and others. So what are you going to be talking about in terms of imperialism and especially linked to the climate crisis?
Yeah, I think the kind of main things that I think we need to be talking about, and certainly people are talking about it, but not enough, is a few different things. One is that we've been talking about climate change in very kind of local ways. So in the North American context, the fight to support the climate and in defense of the climate, you know, when we're talking about things like pipelines or fracking or coal or any of those kinds of things, is a very local one, right? So the impact on local communities, which is, of course, so important because local communities feel that impact. But what is often missing is the ways in which the deepest impacts of the climate are faced in the global south, despite the global south not being the main culprit for climate change. And so I think the climate fight really needs to take up this question of the relationship between the global north and the global south. And, you know, in the lead up to Paris, this is, of course, one of the key issues, which is how does climate change and climate debt and climate reparations and international climate financing, all of these issues are fundamentally about the power and difference and imbalance between the global north and the global south. And that global, you know, that power difference between the north and the south is underwritten by a very long history of imperialism. So that dates back to kind of formal colonial days, you know, the days of formal rule by Europe over the majority of the global south. And also the ongoing kind of imperial relationships, whether it's military relationships or economic imperial relationships structured through neoliberalism that, you know, forcibly devastates the economies of the global south. And, you know, one of the things that has dominated climate discussions, for example, is the rise of India and China and the rise of these economies on the climate crisis. You know, even though we don't talk about how in China, for example, the majority of factories are operating, are producing goods, are operating factories and producing goods for the consumption of the global north, right? So there is a clear link between the economies, the developing economies that are rising in the context of Western imperialism and the kind of hegemonic liberal structures, neoliberal structures that we live under. But also, I think we need to talk about imperialism because that is one of the main drivers of mass migration and displacement. And so climate refugees are estimated at anywhere from 200 to 250 million by the year 2020. A report just came out recently from the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center that said basically there's one climate refugee being produced every second in the past 5 years. And so climate change is one of the drivers of massive movements of people. And, you know, right now the refugee crisis, especially in Europe, has come to light as we've been looking at the number of deaths and drownings that have been happening in the Mediterranean. And we know that there's a number of causes, for example, for the Syrian civil war, which is currently the country that produces the largest number of refugees in, you know, bordering over 15 million refugees in Syria. And some of the reasons of the creation of refugee populations in Syria and of the civil war in Syria are the climate and imperialism. They're certainly not the only factors, but they are contributing factors. So, you know, we know countries like Canada and the U.S. have been engaged in bombing campaigns in Syria. But as you mentioned, you know, talking about imperialism has been on the wane. So there's not a kind of a vibrant anti-war, anti-imperialist movement that is naming the complicity of Western countries in the bombing and hence the displacement of Syrians and creating Syrian refugees. And we also know that one of the kind of contributing factors to the civil war in Syria was the drought that Syrian farmers experienced just in the lead up that created massive amounts of tension and conflict in the region. And so these kinds of factors are alive, and they're alive in other parts of the world, like the Philippines, like Bangladesh, you know, incredible amounts of rates of drought and displacement in Mali, for example. All of these kinds of factors around economic devastation, war, military imperialism, and climate change are all drivers of mass displacement and mass migration. So for me, there's a clear link between climate change, imperial policies, and the kind of trends around immigration that we're seeing in the world today.
So I know you're going to have to leave us early. You're not going to be with us for the full hour, I understand. So I just want our listeners to know that if they had hoped to call in and talk with you directly. But I'm speaking with Harsha Walia from the unceded Coast Salish territory. So, you know, you say that as you introduce yourself, which is, you know, becoming part of the sort of activist protocol, which I think is a really great thing to recognize, you know, the land that we are actually on, this sort of invisibilized history that's sort of been overlaid by, you know, this other these other institutions, other economies, other built environments. And it's sometimes hard to see that because, you know, what we grow up in, the water we breathe, the air we breathe, the water we swim in is exactly that already colonized culture. So maybe, you know, just to talk a little bit about, you know, how you came to see that, you know, because obviously as an immigrant, that may not have been totally evident immediately. You must have had your own journey to understand where exactly you had come to. And that obviously has informed your work, since a lot of the work that you do is also in support with Indigenous people.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, you know, any kind of process of politicization, it's a matter of, you know, talking to folks, deep listening, and also doing our own work to educate ourselves. But certainly when I came to Canada and this part of Turtle Island, a big part of it was, you know, trying to learn the real history of the lands that I came upon. And it included, you know, trying to learn about what the history of settler colonialism was, the ongoing processes of colonialism. When I first came to Turtle Island, I was living on the East Coast in Montreal, which had, you know, had just a few years prior been home to the Oka Crisis, which was the major standoff between Ganiengahaga Mohawk communities and the Canadian state, in a massive standoff that, you know, had made international headlines. And so certainly for me, it was a little bit easier to access that history compared to maybe other parts of Turtle Island, because Indigenous and settler relationships was really at the fore as a result of the Oka Crisis. But, you know, I think anywhere that we live, there is, those histories are actually are alive. You know, Indigenous laws are being practiced on Indigenous lands, Indigenous protocols and jurisdiction is alive. And certainly right now in the climate movement, there's a strong leadership and a necessary leadership coming from Indigenous communities, who are the ones who know best the history of the land, the history of the ecosystem, and the ones who are the most impacted by the devastation of their traditional hunting grounds, their traditional, you know, berry picking grounds, for example, their medicines, because people still rely on, and in major parts, of course, of North America, still rely on the land as their economy, as their subsistence economy, and continue to have an ethical obligation and responsibility to the land that stems from, you know, millennia and generations prior. And so I think, you know, although it may seem that settler colonialism is inevitable, I think it only requires really scratching under the surface to see that Indigenous nations are alive, that, you know, colonization has attempted to annihilate these systems, but has not done so successfully entirely. And also that this is not just history, right? It's not just the history in textbooks that were mistaught. It is ongoing. You know, so in Canada, for example, and similar in the States, residential boarding schools are only a few decades old. And these were an attempt to completely culturally annihilate Indigenous peoples, to tear people from their communities. And this, you know, this history is very recent. And so I think it's really important to also understand settler colonialism, not just as a project of the past that is somehow completed, but as an ongoing process that we today are also complicit in and need to be really aware of in supporting Indigenous communities and Indigenous nations and their struggle for sovereignty.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be the clear link between the sort of the bigger global picture that you're talking about and the, you know, what's closer at hand to us. And I've always felt that, you know, one of the best things maybe we can do to combat imperialism is seeing as how the United States and Canada sort of built their national state power and their ability to project that power around the world upon the vast resources of these continents. So we, you know, allying ourselves and, you know, challenging, even though it seems, I think, quixotic to a lot of people, you know, the idea of decolonization here in either the United States or Canada. Nevertheless, that seems to be one of the strongest things we can do. But I just, you know, I know you have to go. I just want to ask you, there's one caller who really wants to ask you a question before you go. Are you able to take a call or two?
Sure. I can take one.
Okay. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'll make it quick. You know, there have been a lot of people at this a lot longer than me, but Desert Storm and the invasion of Panama really kind of got me into this. But Derek Jensen has called this culture irredeemable. Morris Berman has said that a society that has commerce at its center has no culture. I rack my brain trying to understand, where does the momentum come from to keep this thing going that spreads so much misery and unhappiness and destruction all over humanity? Where does the momentum come from? We're coming up on Indigenous Genocide Day, and families will be gathered around the table. And this is what I want to get at. What is it that people hold in such high esteem? Where do people derive their identities from? They value each other based on the money that they're making. Is this where people's identities are wrapped up in this so-called achievement? Is this where the momentum for this imperialist nightmare is coming from? Thanks.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I would have to disagree with the idea that we don't have a culture. I guess it depends what kind of, you know, how we define culture. But I think one of the ways in which capitalism and militarism and imperialism continues is because it has seeped into the social fabric of our lives. And that is what informs culture. So, you know, the culture of capitalism, the culture of consumerism, these are cultures. I'm not suggesting that they're cultures to celebrate. I think they are hollow cultures, but they are there. And I think any, you know, kind of political and economic system only survives because of the ways in which we internalize it in the very intimate ways of our social and personal identities, like you've said. And so I think definitely the ways in which it continues is the attachment that people have to it. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that is very obvious is that most people who are, you know, a lot of people who may be opposed to, say, war or climate change really do think that any attempt to change climate change and to change imperialism and militarism is going to have a direct negative impact on their life, right? The idea that people will not survive without their mega cities, their mega kind of concrete jungles, their malls, all of that. And so I think people's identity has been very much linked to consumerism, where people know more about brands than they do about, you know, trees, right? There's the saying that a four-year-old kid knows 100 times more about corporate branding than they do about the ecosystems that they live in. And so I think this happens at a very young age, where identity is completely identified through consumerism, by the ability to accumulate consumer goods, and certainly, yeah, through, you know, an identity based on this presumed meritocracy, where our identity is shaped through how much we produce and consume, not only consume, but also produce within the capitalist economy. So, you know, how our wage labor is commodified through this. And kind of some of the other systems that radiate through that, so imperialism, for example, because we are so isolated from our means of production, you know, because we're not actually seeing the people in sweatshops who, for example, produce our clothes, because we are alienated and isolated deliberately through capitalism, where that means of production happens halfway across the world and we don't have to have any contact with it because of mass-scale industrial capitalism, it means that we continue to live the way we live without needing to care about what happens in other parts of the world. And that's, of course, then underwritten further by racism, right? Where what happens to brown and black bodies locally and globally is not something that most, you know, white middle-class people need to care about, because it's not their life, and also because they have the privilege not to care about it, and because those bodies look different, those humanities are made to look different. And so I think it's kind of a circular question and answer in some ways, or it's a circular answer in some ways, because I think what feeds this culture is the culture itself, is the idea that this is how we live. And I think the thing that is most dangerous about it is the sense of its inevitability, right? The idea that this is the only system we can live under, when in fact that's not true. When we go to other parts of the world, there are entire communities who are living a completely different way. And this isn't just, you know, small communities in remote areas of the global south. But, you know, we can even look to, you know, there are deep flaws, but if we look at certain communities, you know, certain countries in Europe, for example, people are, you know, increasingly relying on things like solar energy, which is, you know, not an adequate solution by any means, but there is at least an understanding of needing to switch to renewables, for example. So I do think part of it is the inevitability of it, the assumption that this is the only way that we can live, that this is the only system that will generate prosperity and happiness for people, when in fact that's not true, right? We know more and more people are suffering from mental health crises, for example, as a result of the intensity and the isolation that capitalism propels us into.
Yeah, well, I mean, the idea there is no alternative, you know, is not just an ideology, it's a practice. I mean, there's a continually eliminating any alternative that struggles to raise its head, or any alternative that struggles to persist as the indigenous communities along the Columbia River or, you know, wherever they might be. So, you know, you let us know when you've got to go. I'll certainly keep you as long as we can.
I'm going to have to go. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about based on what you said, and we'll have a chance to meet you again. You'll be here. And I did want to ask you briefly about the other person you're with. It's not just going to be you on the speaking tour, Luz Rivera as well. You're going to be here on Sunday, November 8th at the First Unitarian Church Elliott Chapel from 5 to 7 p.m. Southwest 12th in Maine. You want to just say a quick thing about Luz or any other thing about what you're going to be talking about before you have to go?
I'm sorry, I actually have no idea, but Luz, I think, is only on that stop.
Oh, okay.
So unfortunately, I don't know a lot about them. I think the local organizers have.
Oh, I'm sorry,
them.
I didn't. I'll read something from the Facebook page. So thank you so much.
Sounds good.
Harsho Walia, we really appreciate your being able to join us here this morning.
Thank you so much.
Okay. See you on Sunday. And that was Harsho Walia from the unceded Coast Salish Territories, otherwise known as Vancouver, BC. And we didn't get to talk about her book, Undoing Border Imperialism, which I was able to pick up the last copy of at Powell's Books yesterday. It's really worth reading. It talks about the idea, you know, since Vancouver is just across the river, the so-called border there, the 49th parallel, and there's a whole history to that, how Canada became Canada and all that we also don't tend to talk about too much, even though we live so close. And I did want to ask her about Cascadia. That's a whole other subject of conversation. I'm sure they had some thoughts about. But I know we had a caller who had an announcement, and there's a whole bunch of things that I wanted to talk about, because coming up in Portland, this today at City Council is a major initiative on dealing with fossil fuel transport and storage infrastructure, which was on the Joan Abe show yesterday. They talked about that extensively. We can talk about that. We can talk about things that Harsha brought up. But I believe we had another caller who wanted to make an announcement or a comment. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Am I on the air? This is Dale Feek.
Hi, Dale.
Hi. I want to make an announcement for hearing tomorrow, November the 5th at 6 o'clock at the Civic Center in Hillsboro. That's at 150 East Main Street, Hillsboro Civic Center. It has to do with Intel's toxic, I call it toxic air, but air quality permit application. It's official hearing testimony will be taken, and it for people to come and express their concerns about the air toxins that Intel wants to put in the airshed. So if anybody lives within 25 miles of the Intel Rhinor Acres or the Aloha chip-making facility, you may want to come to the public hearing Thursday, November 5th at Hillsboro Civic Center.
Okay, that's Hillsboro Civic Center, 6 p.m., 150 East Main Street. That's tomorrow. Any particularities about that? What some of these toxic chemicals might be?
Yes, Intel was fined $143,000 for illegally putting fluoride emissions. Those all kinds of fluoride compounds, not what the dentists do with your teeth, but hydric fluoric acid, very very volatile compounds. So 6.4 tons of fluoride. 178 tons of volatile organic compounds, 34 tons of small particulate matter. That's the particulate matter that goes direct in your lungs, and you can't sort of, your lungs don't have the capacity to get it out. So all that, 229 tons of carbon monoxide, 197 tons of nitrogen oxides, and 24 tons of hazardous air pollutants, which includes 9 tons of hydrogen fluoride, 2 tons of chlorine, 2 tons of hydrogen cyanide, and 1.5 tons of methanol. That's just some of them. All of these emitted toxins are potential cancer or lung disease-causing substances.
And
based
on
the go ahead.
No. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Based upon the last thing you just interviewed, you know, we're talking about climate change. Well, Intel is also asking to emit 819,000 tons of greenhouse gases. That calculates to 1.5 tons per minute. That's about the same amount of carbon dioxide equivalent that the natural gas electricity power plants in Boardman area emit per year. Now, the coal-fired electricity plant produces 2 million tons of greenhouse gases per year, but we're phasing that out because it's coal, right? But Intel will be then in the top 5 worst greenhouse emitters in the state, and 2 or 3, and their natural, anyway, 819 tons per minute.
You know, that's
per year.
This is an important conversation. You know, it's, you know, the whole, like, underside of the computer revolution, it really is this huge. I mean, what you're talking about, the toxic solvents used to make the chips, the incredible increase in energy use from a lot of these, you know, centers. What are they called? You know, the server centers and whatever, the
data
servers. I mean, there's this whole, you know, and people just don't like to talk about that because somehow there's this almost this image that, you know, they're sort of part of this, you know, the new economy, which, you know, is sort of, you know, is somehow greener or cleaner than the old, you know, smoke belching, you know, factory economy. And is that something you've thought about?
Yeah, but it's not true. That one thing about, I'm really involved in this. I'm a negotiation team, all kinds of stuff. I've been dealing with this since September of 2013 when DEQ had their first hearing on the Intel toxic emissions. And it didn't go away. Intel now wants to double or quadruple what they originally applied for in 2013, but they stopped that permitting because they got caught cheating and lying about the fluoride emissions. And also they started building the D1X plant, the new $2, $3 billion plants, because they didn't have a valid construction permit. But yes, the problem is that these semi-manufacturing industries, in particular Intel, put millions of dollars in their public relation campaign. So everybody thinks they're a very clean industry, but they're one of the dirtiest industries there is because of the toxic chemicals they use. And it's just horrendous because I have a list of all the chemicals they have. So, you know, we get a trade-off. We get all this stuff that you can do by email and all the things, but it comes with a huge environmental problem.
And Intel probably gets a lot of tax breaks, right, to be located where they are.
Well, they got tremendous tax. They got 30-year of tax breaks worth, what was it worth? Billions of dollars. 30 years, $100 billion. I mean, it's just obscene from my point of view.
So they get these tax breaks to be situated in a local community, and so they're not really necessarily even, you know, I guess, you know, there's jobs, obviously. That's they're always the big argument is they produce jobs.
Right.
But they're not necessarily giving back what, you know, a more diversified local economy might contribute. And then they're leaving this incredibly toxic legacy and, you know, poisoning people. That seems kind of diabolical somehow.
Well, it's really not just. And so there have been two books written. One of them is called Boiling Frogs, Intel versus the Village. That's the village of Corrales, New Mexico, because there's a Intel plant right above that community. Another book that was written is called Intel Inside, New Mexico, a case study of environmental economic injustice. And so that was in the 1990, 2000, and the fight still goes on. And so there people, it's as I talked last night in a political group, it's easier to get to not pay your taxes, as Intel doesn't do. And in New Mexico, they end up building a whole new high school. They just build it. But it would have been better for the public if they'd have paid their taxes, and then they can build more than one high school. So their tax giveaways and Hillsborough School District in particular, because I've worked with the superintendent, that's Mike Scott, and the school board members, and I'm trying to let them, they've been all informed, because I've given all the data that I've done for the last 2-3 years about the problems. And so here they get benefit, but they don't really consider the medical issues that are going to be created by the kids that go to that school because they live close to the Intel and other semiconductor manufacturing plants.
Yeah, you know, that's I was down for a few months down in southern West Virginia a few years ago before I moved back out to Oregon, and one of the big issues that people were focusing on in the Coal River area was Massey Energy, I believe it was, had they had a number of things. They had a huge tailings pond, which was located above an elementary school, and then they had a coal processing plant, which pumped massive amounts of coal dust on that school, and that's a problem all throughout Appalachia. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, that's still going on, a mountaintop removal. Anyway, you know, that was a huge issue, and they finally did succeed. You know, they didn't succeed necessarily in closing down that plant there, but they did succeed in finally convincing the school district, the whatever county, the state, to move that elementary school at least, you know. But the things you're talking about, I mean, that was, but even, you know, it took, you know, years, decades to get that done. But the coal dust was like you could every day apparently rub your finger along the walls and, you know, it would be black. So it was pretty obvious and you could just pretty easily see what it would be like in your lungs. But you're talking about something that's a little more invisible, and it's something, anyway, it's very, I'm really glad you brought this up. I think this is a really important issue that I for one hadn't really gotten on my radar. So I appreciate that.
Well, and I hope, you know, one problem is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and I've read syllabuses that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce doesn't believe in global warming and climate change. And so what they do, they're highly paid lobbyists. They lobby our federal legislators to decimate our environmental protection laws so that, anyway, so it's, and so you got Intel that's a big donor to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. But you got Nike and Apple who removed, they do not belong to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because they've made statements that climate change is real and global warming is happening and we need to do everything we can to stop it. But Intel contributes thousands and thousands of dollars to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And this is another problem with the Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce. Even though the local Chamber of Commerce, many of them don't belong to the U.S. Chamber, they still receive don't pay the big bucks to belong to it, but they still receive all the mailings from them. And so they have this mantra of jobs at all costs. You know, jobs, jobs, jobs.
Well, that's been the argument in just about every you know, environmental issue I've ever been involved with. It seems to be the general mantra of this system. And of course, I was involved with Earth First, and I think we had a very pithy slogan. There are no jobs on a dead planet, and we do seem to be doing our very best. I mean, I use we in the most general sense to make that happen. But I just want to mention that another caller is tuned into this issue. I got a note from my board operator, our news and public affairs director, Kathleen Stevenson, and the caller says that Intel is doing this since 1978. DEQ only found out by accident, and nothing was done to stop them. So obviously you're not the only one, but so are there any groups out there to you know, tune into, to get involved with, that are working on this issue?
Yes, I'm a member. I'm the chair of the Air Quality Committee of the Washington County Citizen Action Network. Washington County Citizen Action Network. We have a very good website with many links on the issue since 2013. The Washington County Citizen Action Network. If you Google it, you'll find all kinds of information. I'm also starting a new group called Hillsborough Air and Water, because water is an issue, too, toxic emissions going in the water system. And this is a project of the Portland Clean Air. And so we're just getting this thing started. It'll be more things known about it soon. But I'm also on, anyway, so those are two important groups. The other, yeah, I think that would be the, those.
Okay.
Two.
Well, great.
But the important thing is tomorrow, Thursday, November the 5th, 6 p.m. start, can't go till 9, at the Hillsborough Civic Center, 150 East Main Street. Please come.
Okay.
If you live within 25 miles of Intel, and if you are like me, and we and the group I'm representing, myself plus a group of people, if you're, we need you to come and express your concerns and what you want.
And they can get in touch with you through that Washington County Citizen Action Network website, I take it. Or is there like an email or?
No, I'm just going to give him my cell phone number. Call me. Here's my cell phone number. You ready?
Yep.
503-504-5972. I'll say it again. 503-504-5972.
And that was Dale calling from Hillsborough. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. That's you know, what we try to do here. And this was kind of a by accident. And that's sometimes the best way to go. People, I really do encourage people to call KBOO and alert us to these things. KBOO's, that's kind of our job. So thank you, Dale. We really appreciate your calling in with that.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And I haven't been doing it enough, but I do have my own email address, and I know a lot of people have written me, and I haven't been the best correspondent, but I'm still working on how to you know, leverage my my position as a talk show host here to facilitate greater communication amongst people in our listening area, and to facilitate citizen action or a non-citizen action, whatever, people who live and care about what's going on. PaulRKBOO@gmail.com. That's my KBOO-specific email address. And the phone number is 503-231-8187. If you have a burning interest, our guest was only able to stay with us for about 20 minutes. She will be in town on Sunday to talk about imperialism, climate crisis, and struggle. We got to talk about a couple of those things. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, host Doug McVeigh speaks with Rick Doblin of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS. What a great group. About the therapeutic uses of MDMA. That is hot stuff. I've read quite a bit about that kind of stuff myself, dealing with trauma. They're really bringing back some of that research that got so brutally cut off when they criminalized psychedelics back in the 60s. You know, the uses of LSD for depression and all sorts of stuff. So that'll be Doug McVeigh speaking with Rick Doblin of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies about the therapeutic uses of MDMA at 9 here on KBOO. At 10, it's Air Cascadia Headlines, interviews and commentary with Chris Andre. 10:15, Flashpoints looks at the presidential campaign of Marco Rubio, now funded by hedge fund billionaire Paul Singer. And 11, it's The Bike Show, news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. And as always, we do thank you, KBOO members, for your oh-so-generous support of this station, which would not be able to continue without you. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. So we've got three lines open, I believe, 503-231-8187. I'm here all by my lonesome. Please call and keep me company. So coming up, as I mentioned this morning, this afternoon, In the city hall, city council chambers, they will be considering a strong policy to stop new fossil fuel transport and storage infrastructure in Portland. What is called a landmark resolution will direct city staff to develop rules that lead Portland away from new fossil fuel projects like coal, oil, and propane terminals. Cementing, that's an awkward term, Portland's role as a global leader in combating climate change. Portland will consider a second resolution specifically opposing dangerous and dirty oil trains rolling through our region. Here's how you can be part of this critical moment. Call or email commissioners. Urge them to support the resolutions establishing a strong fossil fuel policy in Portland. There are talking points on the Facebook page. But I'm sure you can find it by looking at new fossil fuel transport and storage infrastructure policy. So, Commissioner Nick Fish, 503-823-3589, nick.fish@ci.portland.or.us. Commissioner Steve Novick, 503-823-4682. Novick, that's N-O-V-I-C-K, at portlandoregon.gov. Commissioner Dan Saltzman at 503-823-4151. Dan at portlandoregon.gov. And I'm going to be at the front desk, as I am every Wednesday morning after my show. And you can call there. I'll just give you one number. You can get all that information and the talking points as well. And our front desk number, as always, is 503-231-8032. So Mayor Hales and Commissioner Fritz are co-sponsoring this, the resolutions. Thank them for their leadership. And you can, I can give you their numbers later. You can get them off websites. Attend the Portland City Council meeting today at 2:30 p.m. Stand in support of the resolution to oppose dangerous oil trains and a strong policy against new fossil fuel infrastructure. Show your support to Portland City Council by submitting a comment. Thousands of comments are needed to support this bold action to steer Portland away from fossil fuel transport projects. The link to comment, oh, I won't get into that. Again, you can find that on their Facebook page. So I think you need to get there a little early to sign up. It starts at 2:30. Portland City Hall is, of course, located at 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue. You know, these things are important. I'm not a huge fan of the institutional setup, which I consider basically a colonial administration. And those are things I believe we do need to talk about. Looks like we do have a caller, but let me just finish my thought here that, but these are important. You know, there's been a major court decisions that have affirmed this. We need to work at all levels. And so I think it's really important to flood the system as the Portland Rising Tide initiative for this fall is. And this goes right along with it. We need to occupy the halls of decision-making. We need to create new halls of decision-making, new public spaces. But let me just also mention that before this starts at City Hall, there's going to be a bike ride to lead to that rally. 12 o'clock meet at BARC, which is at 351 Northeast 18th Avenue. That's the local forest defense and monitoring organization. So meet at high noon if you have time to make it out there for sign and banner making. And at 1 o'clock, amass upon our righteous bicycles and head down to the join the rally in front of City Council with the Climate Action Coalition. So let's go to our caller. David, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good.
Good. I wanted to first start off by saying I want to thank Dale for bringing up the Intel situation. I've been following it for over a year, and it's really important because we're almost in on unattainment, and that would be really bad for Washington County, especially during the winter. Anyways, I'm calling because the Million Student March is happening on November 12th, and everybody really needs to know about this. You know, we're calling for free college tuition, the erase your student loan debt, and a $15 minimum wage for all student workers. Because right now, currently, I'm one of the organizers at Portland Community College. And currently, for student workers, there's a cap of $9.75, which for people who are not mostly non-traditional students, $9.75 is not a living wage. It's nothing that you can support yourself on. So, you know, we're having rallies at all of the PCC campuses, as well as just in Oregon alone, we have PSU, Reed College, OSU, and U of O having rallies, as well as across the country. We're at over 100 rallies right now. And this isn't just like a one-day action. This is the beginning of a movement to retake our public schools.
Excellent. So that's November 12th. Million students. You know, I just got to take this in the spirit which is offered. There's something about this the people, the starting out, start the beginning of these million person march things. Doesn't it sort of raises expectations a little bit? But anyway, that's just my little personal thing. I think they're all great, and hopefully you all will reach a million person. And it doesn't even matter, because as you say, this is, you know, this is movement building. So that's November 12th. And is there a way that people can plug in to get more information about that? To you know?
Yeah, you can. People can go on Facebook, go to Million Student March Portland Community College or Million Student March PSU for local people. There are Facebook pages for all of the campuses that are involved, as well as the national webpage, I believe, which is studentmarch.org. And they have a list of all the campuses that are taking part, as well as, you know, information for people as to why we're doing this.
So again, the primary issues behind this this initiative
are the eraser of student loan debt, because people who have already gotten through college are still, you know, are racked with $40,000 worth of debt on average, and you know they'll be paying that off for the rest of their life. And that's wrong when, you know, education is supposed to be the great equalizer. Now it's the great equalizer for the rich, as well as free student tuition, which there are multiple. I mean, Bernie Sanders just introduced into the Senate a way by taxing Wall Street at very, very low amounts. I mean, we're talking all three of them are less than 0.5% tax, and that would pay for tuition for all public colleges and universities, as well as our last one is a $15 minimum wage for all campus workers.
Which would obviously help people, you know, people who are on scholarships or low-income students, because, you know, a lot of people are, so if they're the ones who take those college jobs, and if obviously it'd be a lot easier if the wage was somewhat higher.
Exactly.
Well, David, thank you so much for calling in. And this is, you know, these movements are all important. All of them are important, and hopefully they are converging to a greater extent so we can really have something like a more of a cohesive movement that's anti-imperialist, decolonist, anti-capitalist.
Decentralized.
So, yeah, let's keep up the conversation. I thank you so much for calling, and really appreciate it. And so go to Million Student March on Facebook and find out more. November 12th, coming up.
Yes, at 1 p.m.
At 1 p.m., missed that one, at all the PCC campuses, all of the PCC campuses?
Yes.
Okay, and they are many and various. So thank you so much, David. Appreciate it.
And thank you so much. Have a great day.
Okay. And I also got a call from someone who helped me out in my floundering here and trying to get you more specific information about how to get the talking points and further information on the vote at City Council today, in addition to just going to Facebook and trying to find it. You can go to risingtide.org or 350pdx.org. And I believe the Climate Action Coalition also has a website, which is a very interesting group. They are formed of these various different organizations that are working on climate justice. So those are some pointers. Anybody else got anything to add? Please give me a call. We have about 6 minutes left in the show, and the number is 503-231-8187. Joe from Corvallis. You're on the air.
Great. Thank you very much, Paul. Mm-hmm.
I have something I've been thinking about that when the TPP got approved on Fast Track, it seemed like we were handed a bit of an opportunity if we seize it. And the idea that I'd love to see happen is an Occupy the Congressional Offices, essentially come up with an organization that is able to reach out to people in every district throughout the country and organize so that we put people into their home offices.
Well, maybe if we limit it for the time being to Portland, Corvallis, Oregon, might be a good start.
Well, that's a good idea, too, because Oregon's being leaned on because we have so much to gain from the TPP and from our trade with all of these other countries. But it's going to take a serious...
Well, that's a very liberal use of the word we.
I know that.
What do you mean we? There's an old joke. What do you mean we, white man? But anyway, we won't go into all that. But that is a question we've talked about a lot. You know, who really does gain? It's certainly not most working people. Seems to be. Obviously, the fossil fuel industries will find a lot easier to carry out these projects, even though they seem to be having a fairly easy time using eminent domain, even from foreign corporations, to gain access to people's property to put pipelines through and to build these insane liquefied natural gas terminals in earthquake and tsunami-prone territories. But so what are some issues you got going in Corvallis, you know, that now that you're on the air? You know, I've always wanted to use this program a little more to, you know, bring in our far-flung listening areas. So that's a good idea. I think that's something worth pursuing. We need to talk about that more. How, you know, occupying, you know, the spirit of Occupy, bringing it directly, you know, not just following along the institutional channels of, which is good, which is helping to put pressure to actually pass far-reaching laws and resolutions that actually have some teeth that can actually both do something directly to impact the climate change issue and set an example. But, you know, things like, you know, these vaster initiatives like the TPP, you know, where's the energy to actually take it up a notch to hold our public, our elected representatives responsible? I take it that's where you're going with this.
Well, I am, and pardon me, I got onto listening to the show late, and so I didn't realize you were trying to contain it to the local area. And also don't want to be misunderstood that when I say the we, I say it very facetiously that we
right.
have,
that
there's a pretty big campaign going on to say that this is, the TPP is good for Oregon. The TPP is good for all the states on the West Coast because we'll have this opportunity. And I want to see it go down in flames, and because it's going to be fast-tracked, if we were to mount some kind of a very convincing show of opposition on a single day, I think that would send a very important message. And maybe we do just concentrate on Oregon for now, but I'd love to find a group that has the ability to get out throughout the country
to
congressional offices.
Yeah, but I mean, you have to start. I mean, you know, you have to sort of, you know, set lead by example, I think is where it's at. That's what, you know, the spirit of a, you know, direct action is, that you don't wait for everybody else to do things. You act, you know, in the best way, and then that inspires other people to act, and then, you know, maybe you can join in with the other people. But anyway, so no, I think that's a great idea, and I encourage you, and maybe another time we can talk more specifically about, you know, specific issues that are going on in Corvallis, because we don't hear enough about that. But we're going to have
enough.
To...
Well, I'd love to engage in that one at some other point. Like I said, I just thought there was an opportunity to throw out my big grand TPP idea.
Okay. And hopefully people pick up on that. And again, you know, if anybody that inspires anybody, I got my email address, paulrkabu@gmail.com, and you know, I can link people up if, you know, people write me and want to connect up with someone else and they give me their email address, then I can do that, you know. So but I'll need, you know,
well, I will
I will write to you, okay. And so that you will be able to connect anybody up if they are interested.
Okay, there you go.
See this one happen.
I'm willing to do that, and hopefully it will go somewhere. And that's true for, you know, any other thing that we bring up like that. I do want to, you know, I know I've been talking about this for about a year, and I've probably frustrated some people who have written me and wanted to get this kind of thing going. But, you know, I'm only one person, and I would like to actually, you know, develop more of a collective here around what I'm trying to do with this specifically. And I think we could do that more with what we're doing in our public affairs. But that's a subject for another discussion. We only have a minute left, so we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you all so much for listening. Go check out Harsha Walia, who will be at in Portland on Sunday, along with Luz Rivera, who has 20 years of experience, Luz Rivera Martinez, who has 20 years of experience constructing autonomy, organizing outside the electoral system, and resisting genetically modified corn while protecting millennia-old varieties. An amazing, inspired speaker with a wealth of experience, and her talk will have important lessons for anyone interested in human rights, women's, peasant, and labor movements. She works with the Consejo Nacional Urbano Campesino. And if you miss her on the 8th Sunday, you can see her again on the 9th, and there's a Facebook events page which I will post to my site. I wasn't able to post last week's site because we had a problem with our audio. I'll try to do that. I have to go. Thanks so much for listening. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a dance party benefit for Safer Streets on Saturday, November 7th at 9 p.m. at Crush in Portland. Safer Streets offers free self-defense classes in various easily accessible locations for women in the Portland metro area who are experiencing homelessness, poverty, mental health or addiction issues, for sex workers, and for survivors of violence or abuse. Safer Streets is queer and trans-friendly and welcomes and meets attendees at their particular needs or abilities. That's a dance party with DJ Aurora to benefit Safer Streets, Saturday, November 7th, 9 p.m. at Crush, 1400 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.